CliffCentral.com.
All right, CliffCentral.com on a Wednesday morning. And usually around this time, we have a guest. And I'm very, very pleased to see Daryl Bristow-Bovey again for the first time in ages. You say it's, what, 10 years since we last saw each other?
10 years, exactly. 10 years since I wrote my last book.
God, that's a long time.
It's the only reason I write books these days, so I can get to see you again, Gareth.
But dude, I have known you for a long time. I mean, it must be close to 20 years that we've known each other.
It was 20 years. I remember I was actually just driving over here, remembering the first time. Was it a boxing match?
Oh my God, at Carnival City or something, wasn't
that's
it?
That's right, yeah, yeah. Or maybe Caesar's Palace or something.
That was in the days where, like, you know, people would go to events and there was a prestige and an excitement around these things. I mean, it was so stupid.
We put on our good t-shirts.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. We dressed up for things like that.
Yeah.
In fact, I can't remember who was actually in the match, it was a major thing. And it was late at night or early in the morning or something
late
like
at night,
that.
That's
yeah,
right.
It was bizarre.
Yeah.
So let me just give a quick introduction so that everybody else knows. Because, I mean, the most amazing thing about you is that you do have a long and very, very cool history in writing, but you're a prize-winning author, you're a screenwriter, you're a travel writer, you're a newspaper and magazine columnist. A lot of that stuff sounds a little bit archaic because the media world has changed so much. But those things used to be, I mean, if you could call yourself just any one of those things I've just called you, you were like at the top of the food chain. And in some ways you still are, because it's a quality and ability, a talent that very few people have. You've written 5 books. They've been translated into 7 different languages, including Spanish, Estonian, and Portuguese. You're born in South Africa. You studied under, and this is amazing, and we've got to talk about this a little bit, J.M. Coetzee and André Pierre Brink. I mean, to learn from people like that who have become international juggernauts in their own space and time is quite something. But the most amazing thing about this is that you... And I picked this up from your new book, which is a real exploration of the Shackleton expedition. It's about the Endurance, which, of course, they found the ship at the bottom of the Antarctic Ocean. And your father has an intimate connection to that. But one of the chapters, you start off going, oh, well, I'm sitting in Greece. And I thought, what a life this guy has. So you spend a lot of your time in the Peloponnese. You got a house there or something?
I'm building a house there.
That's so cool. How did that happen in between? I mean, I should have stayed in contact with you. I might have got an invite to your house in the Peloponnese.
Listen, it's not...
How often are you there?
It's not too late for that. So I'm building the house, right?
Right.
So the great thing about building a house in Greece is that you get to work with the most optimistic people on earth. You know, a Greek builder is always going to be finished next month. so that's been a couple of years now. We have walls, we have floors, we have some ceilings. So I reckon in another year, there's a guest wing that'll be just perfect for your studio away from home. No, we bought that in over the internet during lockdown. So for about 6 years, I haven't had a home. I've been sort of roaming the world. And each month I stay in a different city or a different country.
Yeah.
And then, which is great, right?
Yeah,
and
of course.
And so suddenly it's lockdown and you don't have anywhere to go. So we came back from Los Angeles and we're in a borrowed flat. And I thought, this is no good. A man needs room to roam. Yeah. I need to be able to walk out of my house and have nobody tell me, go back inside. And have people in Cape Town shout at me out of the windows because they don't believe that I'm walking a dog, which I wasn't because I don't have a dog. And so we bought the land off the internet. There was nothing. There's nothing. There's no electricity. There's no.
It was very expensive.
No, it's very cheap.
Really?
Yeah, I'm attracted. You don't know this. And do they? I'm attracted to cheap things.
No, that's okay.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with being attracted to cheap things as long as you yourself aren't cheap.
Correct.
What made you think of Greece? And are they very friendly and welcoming to, I mean, do you, for example, have to apply for a visa every time you go back to your house?
No, I don't, because after a certain point of spending money, they give you a residency.
Oh, that's handy.
But,
that's very handy.
But Greece, because they are so lovely, I'd spent like in the previous years before, I spent a month on different islands and Athens.
What a place.
And they're the nicest people, you know.
Yeah.
And you never really know if they're really angry or if they're being very welcoming, because it's just a lot of shouting and hand-waving and banging on the table. But it turns out they're always friendly.
All right, so let's get straight into this book because I really loved it. I sometimes read the entire book when I've got someone who comes in for an interview, and sometimes you just don't have time. You've got maybe three or four books to get through in a week, and I'm interviewing people at various times a day, and I don't get through the whole thing. And I did with you. And partly that's because, I mean, I've read some of your previous books and I love the way you write. I'm just going to go to this to give people an illustration of what I mean, right? So here you are just casually penning this little chapter. You go, life is expansion and multiplication, a dazzling scattering of light, an infinity of brightness and surprise. And although much is lost along the way, not merely does more abide, more is added. Delight is added. Insight and wisdom are added. Beauty and bravery are added. I suppose what I'm trying to say, and sometimes struggle in my day-to-day life to remember, is that the world is a trembling threshold of possibility, of conjunctions and contradictions, of opposite things that can be true at the same time. We're doomed and we're not. We can go home and we can't. Past is over and the past is still changing. Lost things are lost and lost things come back. I mean, that's good shit.
I wish you'd read my audiobook, man. That was perfect.
It's good to read stuff that, you know, I said to you just before we started the interview, lots of people can tell a story, but they tell it kind of badly. It takes a real wordsmith to be able to tell a story beautifully. So obviously we must start with the fact that you knew, and you must have known as a child, that your father, who at that stage was living in Durban.
Yeah.
And I mean, you're very fair about him. He clearly was a tremendously talented, adventurous man of courage, bravery, fortitude, and all that stuff. But you also paint this picture of this guy who's kind of, you know, he's got this legacy he never really grabbed hold of.
Yeah.
But you must have known as a kid that your dad was on this incredible expedition.
Well, that was one of the things that entwines Shackleton and my father in my head is this very question of what is success, right? You know, what is a successful life? So, you know, Shackleton, who is this poet explorer, but who never actually achieved anything. He never made it to the South Pole. No. He never managed to walk across the continents. He came back from his expedition as a failure. And my father felt much the same way. He was, you know, like you say, a man of talents, I think, and of ambition and of dreams. And of skills, but he grew up in the Depression. He never finished school. He left school at the age of 12. And I think he felt like a failure. And in some ways, you know, he presented as a failure to me. And when he was young, I used to lie in bed with him and used to at night after he'd had his first stroke, and he would tell me stories of his life. Right? And so for me as a kid, you know, your father tells you stories. It's he's the hero. He's the central thing in your life, you know, and his stories created this sort of mythical figure. And of course, yeah, he was a great storyteller. He was a fantastic storyteller. And like all good storytellers, not all of his stories, I think, were true. And so one of the things he told me was that he had been with Shackleton on the Endurance when they sailed in 1914 down to go and cross the Antarctic, and he'd got stuck in the ice and he'd come back from the ice and now he'd settled down in Durban. And even as I grew older and I sort of put the dates together and realized, yeah, he would have been five at that time. I still couldn't quite believe that he hadn't been on the ship, because he knew all of these details. He knew personal details about Shackleton that he couldn't have known and that have only subsequently come out in learned biographies that were written after he died. So one of my journeys in this book was to figure out how he could possibly have known any of that if he wasn't, in fact, on the ship. And I worked through many theories. So he might have been a stowaway, the cabin boy, you know, yeah. Shanghaied.
Right.
But I come up with a solution that I think sort of...
But there's a part of you that kind of wants to believe your dad is part of something like this.
Yes.
And then there's a part of you that is extremely skeptical of this just because you're a realistic sort of human being.
Right.
And I think we all come to a point where we realize that our fathers are not superhuman.
Yeah.
And I think it's difficult for any, especially young man, but young girls as well, to realize like your dad can't save you from everything. They're not yes. good at everything. They don't know all the answers.
And that's part of the journey, right? Of
yeah.
adulthood is
yeah.
that yeah. is yeah. you know that it can't be true. It's just another person like me. But there's a part of you that yearns for that and yearns for that moment of childhood, right? That where you're whole and part of feeling whole is feeling like there was a superhuman figure who could look after you and make everything all right.
And then, you know, that we also have to see that the end of the age of adventurers was more than a century ago.
Yeah.
I mean, all the places, with the possible exception of the moon in the 60s,
yeah.
all the other places have been explored.
Yeah.
We had to go into space because there was no ocean deep enough anymore. Mm. There's no forest that was left untrod by the explorers of the European world.
Yeah.
There was no far-flung continent. And even Antarctica and the Arctic, which is just ice, had been conquered. You know, there were people like Amundsen. There were people who'd traversed these incredible wastelands of just cold and misery and frostbite and shit. To come back with the accolade. And Shackleton was not given any accolades because he didn't make it and he lost the ship too.
Yeah. And also he did it during the First World War. You know,
there were lots of distractions.
Yeah, they were away in the ice. And so when he came back after this incredible, it's one of the great stories of adventure and survival of all time. And when he comes back, people go, but what, you know, you should have been fighting and dying in the fields of France. And it's one of the first examples, I think, of people telling other people who are doing wonderful things,
yeah.
I think, extraordinary human things. No, that's not what you should be focused on. They're more important social issues that you should be
Well, it's like those
on.
People who tell rich people they shouldn't be helping this charity, they should be helping that one, as if
right,
it was their
right.
money.
Yeah, or you know, you shouldn't be allowed to go down in a submersible.
That was a big thing.
Yeah,
those five people who went
rich,
down to see
right?
the Titanic. Oh, how dare they spend their own money going down there and putting their life at risk to just do something that the rest of us can't afford?
Yeah,
how rude.
Yeah,
shouldn't you rather be spending that on starving people or whatever?
Yeah.
So, when you wrote this, I mean, there must have been. Because you've done a huge amount of research too. You tell us about where all the various people who were on the expedition ended up, what they ended up doing. And there are some South African links there too. Mm-hmm. But kind of when did the whole story start to make sense for you? And when did you separate fact from fiction in terms of what you'd been told, what you believed, and what you discovered? Because that's an exploration of its own.
That is. And, you know, I've been obsessed with the Shackleton story ever
But there's a name for you guys who are obsessed with it.
Shackleheads.
Shackleheads, yeah. That's right.
It's a name that's caught on quite a lot. I invented it.
It works.
In my pitch for the book. And so I keep running into people and I'm saying, oh, I too am a shacklehead. Oh, you indeed. I want that to be an entry in the Oxford Dictionary under my name one day. last year when they found the Endurance and it's at the bottom of the Weddell Sea and it's in the clearest seawater on Earth and because there's no oxygen down there and there's no bacteria that eats the wood, it's pristine and perfect. And one of the sailors, Shackleton's right hand man, a guy called Frank Wild, all through his journals, sort of complains about having to leave his good boots behind.
Oh.
And you can see them on the deck of the boat, and the leather stitching is still there. And when I saw that, there was this moment of joy, you know. This, and it was in the newspapers and the websites of the world, where people were suddenly, you know, sharing these beautiful photographs and saying, "Look at this incredible thing." And it was that moment where I just suddenly thought, "Wow, that's one of the few news stories I've seen recently where there's nothing. No one's angry about anything. You know, no one's blaming anybody for doing anything. They've just found this thing that's come back like a gift." From the world, the lost a place of lost things and something's been found, and so that's what kind of kick started this journey to sort of go back through time and to look into the future and to sift through all of the evidence.
All right, so I mean, people have to read the book, so we're not going to give away everything, but there's quite a lot of interesting historical anecdotes. And I mean, in one chapter, you talk about the infinite game.
Yeah.
You talk about the difference, and you mentioned success when we started talking here. And people have different attitudes and different ideas of what success is. You know, is success winning and being the first to the pole?
Right.
Is success making tons of money? Is success finding the perfect partner? Is success having wonderful children who grow up to be useful and prosperous and productive adults?
Mm-hmm.
What is success? And, you know, is Shackleton to be regarded as a failure? And how many of us, by the same standard, would fall short?
Yeah. Well, you know, by the measurements of a finite game, Shackleton was a failure. And so was Scott, his great rival in the Antarctic exploration. Scott was on a race to be the first to the South Pole. He gets beaten there by Amundsen. He arrives at the South Pole and sees the Norwegian flag is flying, and he feels like a failure, and he feels so depressed and so saddened by this that he kind of loses heart and degenerates as a leader coming back across the ice, and all of his party die and freeze to death in the tent. And contrasted to that is Shackleton, and I've come to think, you know, my father and people like that whose idea of success is to play a different kind of game from this finite game of winning and losing.
Okay.
And the distinction between finite and infinite games comes from a philosopher called James Cart, who thought of the infinite game as being a game that we play in order to keep on playing, right? And that seems as good a definition of life as I can think of.
A game that you keep on playing.
You play it in order to keep playing.
Right.
You know, the moment somebody, a finite game, when somebody wins, the game ends. Right.
Right.
A game that you keep on playing is a game that never ends, that includes other people, that goes on until you die. And that's what Shackleton was playing. So he tries to go off to the Antarctic. The ship gets frozen into the sea. He needs to get to the Antarctic because he's borrowed all this money that he can only pay back by getting there and completing his expedition. But he doesn't get distressed and depressed. They get frozen into the ice. They have to spend this long polar winter, these men who don't know each other.
Which, by the way, weirdly even on its own, forget about whether you make it to the South Pole or not. Yeah. Most of us would not survive anything approximating that.
No, and the previous expedition didn't. Everyone went mad.
Of course.
And he and Shackleton takes these men who are as remote as any human being has been in the world at that time, and will be again, as you say, you know, until people go to the moon.
Right.
And in some ways, they're more remote, right? Because they don't have radios.
I mean, there wasn't this base in Antarctica that there is now.
No.
You know, at the South Pole, there's this building that there are people in pretty much all year round. And even though there are only a few ships that go there.
Yeah.
You can get there if you want to, and you don't have to be
to
be some sort of survival expert or some kind of person who can eat from tins and heat water miraculously and survive without your fingers falling off. We can all do a trip to the Antarctic now. Yeah. We just take it for granted that it's there and that it's mostly uninteresting, which is also not true.
These guys just don't. No one knows where they are. You know, no one's going to know that they're even missing for another year. And no one has ever been to this particular place that they were before and since until the ship found them. Yeah. And so from the middle of the frozen sea, he just switches his goal. And his next goal is to bring all of his men back alive. And it feels like, which he spoiler alert, he does. And it feels like a kind of a metaphor for what a successful life is. A successful life is somebody is living it in such a way that you aren't so fixed on this one achievement that everything else falls aside by the wayside.
You take other people with you.
And
a lot of this sounds like a sort of claptrap you hear from motivational speakers, but
except this is a man on the ice with other men with actual lives in his hands.
This is not hot air.
It's not some dude in a boardroom telling you to smile and be positive.
All right. Well, I'm glad we both have a detestation for those sort of people. All right. But let's talk about this guy, Oliver Goldsmith, for a second, because I love his system. And there are lots of people who are sitting with debt in South Africa right now.
Yes.
So included in that chapter, you go into a brief description of what he used to do. Is he in any way an ancestor of the Goldsmiths of
money fame?
Of money fame now, because he may well be also Anglo-Irish.
He may well be.
Annabelle's Club. I interviewed Ben Goldsmith the other day.
Oh, really?
Yeah, who's written a book about losing his daughter during COVID, which was, the most devastating thing. It was a farm accident.
Oh, wow.
And his brother's an MP. In fact, his brother's now a lord and the minister for the environment in the UK.
That's right.
His sister, Jemima, married Imran Khan. The mother is Annabelle, famously the club Annabelle's, but you know, this is a very well-to-do family. I think he might be an ancestor of this.
I suspect so.
I'm guessing so. But anyway, what did he do?
He had a fantastic system.
I mean, apart from writing She Stoops to Conquer.
Yeah.
Not a small work.
He was an interesting guy. He was always so depressed about not having any money that his friends once whipped together to buy him a ticket to America. To go try his luck there, and he took the money and spent it all night drinking, and tried to sneak on board the ship as a stowaway. But he had a system where whenever he had another debt come in, another bill to be paid, he'd put it all into a hat, and when he had a little windfall, he would dip his hand into the hat, choose a bill at random and pay that off and keep on paying that off until the windfall had run out. And when certain debtors would come to him and say, you haven't paid for your hats or your pork pies or whatever it was that ate in England in those days, he would explain the system. He'd say, it's a matter of chance. You have to take your chances along with everybody else. And sir, if you don't like it, you are out of the hat.
And so that was it. That was how he solved all his money problems.
It's an ongoing system. You know,
did they accept his explanation?
Well, they had to, because otherwise they weren't in the running when the next windfall came along.
I'm going to think that that's a good way to deal with our banks in South Africa and mortgages and things. We just say to them, you know what? It wasn't your turn in the hat. I'm sorry.
It wasn't your turn.
Pay you this much.
Yeah, we're all ruled by chance and circumstance.
There we go. All right, so let's just talk about the Antarctic, because it's got this sort of romantic and at the same time terrifying reputation. Mm. What can you tell people who've never been there, people who don't know anything about it? It's a forbidding place, obviously.
Yeah.
Most people, when they picture it in their heads, including me, you just picture these white sort of snow and ice covered ranges and flats and just wind blowing. Absolutely chilling, nasty things that want to destroy you with cold, freeze you to death. Is there anything at all redeeming about that landscape?
Look, the polar plateau, which is where the North Pole is the least attractive part of it, and it's the final stretch as you get to the South Pole, and it's the highest land on Earth and windiest and snowiest. But most
land on Earth.
Antarctica is the highest continent on Earth, the driest and the coldest. It's the biggest desert.
So when people talk about Everest being the highest peak,
that's the highest peak. Yeah, but in terms of average height,
That's incredible. Yeah. Okay, so I'm learning new things already. So already three records in a place that we've barely begun to explore. Yeah. Okay.
But most of it isn't the polar plateau. Most of Antarctica is incredibly beautiful lands that surround this continent. And in summer and in spring, it's a place of wonderland when the light is up. Because
this
is
Aurora Australis. Australensis, or what is it?
Yeah, the Aurora Australis, of course.
There we are.
Lovely as well.
Southern.
But just when the sunlight is up, because the sun is at a different angle there than it is in the rest of the world, right? It comes obliquely. So it's constantly coming through ice, bouncing off the snow, and it creates
diffraction.
Refraction and reflection as well. And it creates incredible, rainbow effects and deep, deep colors of blue and orange and yellow, and pink that you don't expect. You expect to see it all white. And it's very seldom white in the spring and in the summer on the ice fields. It feels like being in a gigantic crystalline mushroom trip.
Jeez. Mm-hmm. All right. So why would anyone with their head screwed on right at the time that Scott, that Shackleton, that Amundsen decided to go down there, why would they do that? Was there a tremendous amount of prestige attached to the explorer label, and particularly the explorer who discovers X, Y, and Z? And does that come from the conquistadors or from Diaz or from, you know, all these great Drake, all these people who traversed the world before discovering places?
You know, weirdly enough, we think about that now, but actually they spent a lot of time trying to persuade society that there was a lot of glory attached, because they're trying to get funded. You know, they're all incredibly poor. But actually, they encountered as much criticism and resentment and skepticism as we probably would now. People would say, well, what are you doing down there? And they would have to, they'd make up lies. That, you know, Shackleton was perpetually trying to tell people that, no, they found some coal down there, and they think there might be diamonds, there might be gold. And they'd get people to invest in these expeditions. And there was honestly not a great deal of prestige to be had, especially after Amundsen was the first to the South Pole.
Right.
And after that, all it's like, well, we didn't do that. You know,
everything else will be second best.
It's all been done.
Right.
Exactly. And so these guys keep going, and you don't really know why, except for the fact that Shackleton always said he felt more alive down there. And that he went on land and went in society and when moving through normal life, felt it, that he didn't belong there. And there's some people who are just called to do odd, senseless and extraordinary things. And I think that's part of what the beauty of being of humanity is, right? Is that we are all incredibly different. And at different times, different circumstances, different times of crises, different personalities rise, you know, to the fore. And our, you know, our strength as a species is that there's so much diversity. Now, what that means is that in times of peace and stability, some personalities like Shackleton's or like some of the people who would have been French resistance fighters during the occupation,
sure,
you know, they don't fit into a normal society. And I think my father was actually one of those people, always sort of chafing against discipline and yeah. And you know, being called a maverick and
rebel,
a contrarian.
Yeah.
But in times of crisis, those are the ones when everyone who's not a contrarian is kind of sitting at home and keeping curfew, the curfew that the Germans have given you when they marched into your country in 1940.
Or that the government gave you during COVID.
Well, you know, there are all sorts of parallels. And all. But at different moments of crisis, you need those extraordinary characters. And people like Shackleton had to make their own adventures, I think, in times of without crisis.
Another thing that makes this book really interesting to read, and I can't tell people enough good reasons to pick it up and take a look. There's so many interesting things that you throw in here that absolutely have nothing to do with Shackleton.
Right.
I mean, I didn't know that Berserk and the Berserkers, who were, of course, the kind of elite fighting men of the Norse, the Viking Empire, the Viking conquerors that came on their longboats. The Berserkers were these crazy guys who would go up in the front. They would literally lose their minds. They're probably high on something, but they were fearsome beyond belief. And the term berserk we still use in English today, but it actually comes from bear shirt.
From bear shirt, yeah. They would dress in bear skins to try and occupy the fighting spirits of the bear. The bear, you know, used to be.
Bear is an interesting animal.
The bear is a very interesting animal. It used to be our great fear, well, our European ancestors' great fear. There was this beast that lurked in the darkness at the edge of the villages.
The only big beast in the Northern Hemisphere, really, that caused absolute terror. And bears are not afraid of people.
That's right. And they sort of look vaguely like people, you know.
Bipedal, if they want to.
Yeah, when you see them come, you know, lurching towards you through the hazy darkness. And so there are all sorts of myths and terrors and fears around them. And long before the wolf was the thing in the fairy tale, it was the bear. And then what we did was, because we were so afraid of the bear, we went out of our way to tame it. And so, you know, bear baiting
still happens.
What you have now is that the bear is the cuddly. We've domesticated it to the point where it's the cuddly teddy bear, and it's Paddington, and it's Winnie the Pooh,
we've totally emasculated and broken the bear down. But I mean, we've been obsessed with it to the degree that we've named two constellations after the bear as well.
And this is
Ursa Major, Ursa Minor, yeah.
And this is what Arctic means the place of the bear, because Arctos is the ancient Greek word for bear, and Antarctic actually means the place without the bear, right? Because you can't see
those constellations.
Ursa, and also there are no bears there, but the story of the bear is like, it kind of feels like that's the story of humanity. We have this terrible thing, this strong, powerful thing that's bigger than us. And so we spend all of our time making it small. And so we're bigger than it, as we've done turning into the teddy bear. And then we kind of have to look around for some other new challenge to overcome. So the bear was our first big challenge. And then it became, you know, the natural world. And now it's space, I guess.
I suppose technology also.
Yeah.
A lot of people are struggling with that monster. Yeah. So what about the other people who were on this expedition? Because we talked a little bit about Shackleton, and I'd like you to go into more detail about the kind of personality that this guy had.
Yeah.
But all these people whose lives he effectively saved with some really solid leadership. In any other situation, he would have been considered a tremendous winner.
Yeah.
And I think what your book does is it largely rehabilitates some of his reputation. Because again, unless you're really, really interested in this stuff, it's not lying around for people to just assimilate like on Google.
Yeah.
So this is, there's a lot of novel ideas, theories, research, evidence brought to bear here.
Shackleton's he's quite a good role model for leadership in organizations, because
you're going to be asked to do talks now in those boardrooms that you hate.
The board,
you will.
The well-named
boardroom.
So tell
us what the leadership skills of Ernest Shackleton were in five. Summarize it in 10 points.
Yeah.
Put a PowerPoint together.
Do you have any takeaways? What are the takeaways?
You give us the elevator pitch on Shackleton. Oh Jesus!
Oh, no.
Go on.
But what he did was he had a ship full of incredibly mismatched and unsuited people.
Rabble.
Yeah, yeah. He had some of the scum of the Bristol docks.
Right.
He had some scientists who'd never been to sea before. He had some sort of weird youngsters who just wanted to run away to sea and have an adventure. And none of them got along together very well. But they had to. They were suddenly thrown into a circumstance where they had to be in very tight confines in this wooden ship through a 6 month period where they're frozen into the ice, and the sun never comes up, and the temperature never comes raises much above -35 degrees.
Uh-huh.
And then they have to go through all this physical activity. So what he did was he bonded them together without hugging, kissing, you know, singing,
they weren't
holding
doing
hands.
A drum circle.
They were not doing a drum circle. They didn't do any team building exercises. They didn't have any breakaway groups.
Good, yeah.
But what he did was he recognized the character of each man. He sort of watched them quite closely, and the ones that needed a little bit of a pepping up, he would ask them personal questions, or he'd ask them to do him a favor, and they'd feel a little bit useful. The ones that just wanted to be left alone, he'd happily leave alone. And he kept an eye out for the sort of grumblers and complainers, and the ones what he had a particular dislike for were the people who insisted on their legal rights under the ship's charter. And he would know.
This was survival.
Exactly.
What theoretical nonsense are you pulling out of your book of rights now?
Well, one of his sailors wanted to go on strike when they were walking across the ice. It wasn't in his contract that he had to pull his rations behind him across the ice back to land on a sled, and so he didn't want to do it anymore. And so Shackleton sort of took him aside and explained some of the realities of life, and ended off his very persuasive conversation by saying, and also, you know, if you don't pick up the harness and pull it, I'm going to shoot you, which worked for him. And so Shackleton had this ability to give people what they needed and no more, and to not give them what they didn't need, which is something that not very many managers are good at these days, I think.
Well, getting the best out of people is a real talent, and it's a skill that some people just they're very acute observers, which is something you picked up there about him. But also, there's sort of people who realize that people have different needs.
Yeah.
And I think that this is what's so wrong in the corporate world, is that people are all tarred with the same brush.
Yeah.
Or expected to have the same qualities.
That's right, and even some of the new orthodoxy of everyone being different. You know, everyone has to be different in exactly the same way.
So you mentioned diversity earlier, and you were saying one of the best things about humanity is that we do have those outliers, those contrarians, those people who stick out and do different things and just on principle rebellious.
Yeah.
But obviously diversity is only really good if you have values that you can all accept are common values.
Yeah.
So in this case, survival is the thing. Yeah. We're all buying into that. So even though you're all expected to have different qualities, do different things, need different things,
100%.
You must be attuned to the fact that we are on a mission here to keep living and to make it back to civilization. If they didn't have that in common, diversity wouldn't have helped at all.
That's exactly right. And he imposed certain values, you know, over and above that. And you know, one of them being optimism. No one was allowed to complain. And at a certain point,
what would South Africans of 2023 do if we weren't allowed to complain? It's what we're the best at, us and the British, actually.
It's true.
Oh.
And you know, he would scapegoat and chastise anyone that he discovered complaining, anyone who had gloomy prognostications about the future. At one point, he went to the extreme of forbidding the cook to give extra rations because he knew it would make them feel like they were being coddled, that they that they needed their spirits raising. On another occasion, when the winter was setting in and all of the seals and the penguins had disappeared and so there was no fresh food to come, the guy in charge of stores was suggesting, well, maybe we should lower the rations so, but to make sure we can last the winter. And he wouldn't do that either for fear of making people afraid. And so it's a delicate balance between, you know, practical considerations and psychological, which he was always adjusting, which is an unbelievable skill.
How do you account for optimism in your own life? Because there are people who will call me a blind and stupid optimist sometimes. Mm. I just don't think that there's any really conceivably decent way to live. If you're not optimistic, you may as well just give up. And I mean, there's a healthy dose of cynicism in all of us, right? Yeah. And there should be, unless you're an idiot.
Yeah.
I mean, there are people who have very, 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 very low IQs, are tremendously optimistic, but they don't realize like the stove is hot and you'll burn it if you touch it and shit like that. But how do you account for it in your own life? And are you, because you don't strike me as being an outwardly optimistic person.
Hmm. I think I am. And I think I think I am.
It's not an insult.
No, I know. But it's one of the themes of the book. Yeah, Shackleton was an optimist, and I think I'm an optimist in the same way. Which isn't, you know, when we have these conversations today about climate change or, you know, whatever it is, we get polarized into these two camps. You're either you're either a mad optimist, which turns to kind of denialist. I don't look at anything. I don't care about it. It's all going to be fine. Or you're some kind of a mad pessimist where it's too late. Everything's over. The only thing I can possibly think of to save the world is to throw some orange chalk onto the Wimbledon Central Court.
Right? Yeah, we were talking about those people just before you came on.
Right. It's nuts.
I'll glue my hands to the runway of Hamburg Airport because the world is going to end anyway. So it's the mad apocalyptic denial.
You'll know where I am.
I think we get you. Yeah.
So
you're somewhere in between.
So Shackleton's version of optimism, which I think is mine as well, is that circumstances being what they are, the only possible way to live and the only possible way to make a difference and to survive is to do whatever you can think of doing and to have some kind of faith in human agency. Right, that if human agency got us into whatever situation you might think is the case, then human agency can get us out of that. And what Shackleton would do is whatever he could think of doing, and you know that carrying on was the most important thing. And he didn't always make the right decisions. You know, sometimes they went walking off in the wrong direction, and sometimes they were they were bad strategic decisions. But what was important was not stopping and giving up and despairing and protesting and complaining. It was doing the best thing you can think of doing until you can think of something better and then happily switching course.
I think it's also worth just noting here that he'd been on, two or three previous expeditions before Endurance.
Yeah. Well, and that's a very good
Nimrod example. And Discovery, right?
That's right. Yeah. He went with Scott on Discovery, right. And then he had his own expedition on the Nimrod. And he had held the record for being the furthest south. And he had walked with a couple of men, and they'd come within it's a few days march of reaching the South Pole. And he made the calculation that they could definitely get there, but they could not get back again alive. And it's a mark of his optimism that he said, I'm going to rather turn around and go back again. And that looks like pessimism. Oh, I can't make it there. Yeah. I've given up. No, he went there and came back knowing that he could go again or he could do something else. Whereas Scott got to the same position. And Scott, who was a pessimist, actually, went on to the South Pole, got there second, and died coming back. And it's that kind of – there's a paradox in that because it looks like the guy who just keeps on going no matter what must be the optimist. But no, it's because he's focused on this finite goal and can't realize – that there are other that real optimism is finding a way to keep on going, even if it's not in optimal conditions.
And in American politics now, they would say that you are what do they say? It's when you keep changing your goals, flip flopping, yeah. Right? But of course, this is different because
that's a weird thing about Americans. It's one of the weird things about Americans. Yeah, flip flopping is one of the worst things you can accuse a person of, but. It kind of seems like you'd want somebody who changes their mind with circumstances.
If, for example, you discovered that there weren't weapons of mass destruction, wouldn't the best thing to flip flop and say, well, let's rather just withdraw those men? And
turns out I thought there were, let's not go there.
Or maybe when you discover that there isn't an off-ramp to the Ukraine-Russia situation, that maybe sending cluster bombs is not the best idea. If you flip-flopped on that, we'd be okay with it.
When circumstances change, seems like a sane response to come up with a different idea.
So how did it all end for Shackleton after all of this? Because again, we talk about the way that his reputation has trickled down. And I said that you've done a great job here of, in some ways, rehabilitating his reputation. But how did it end for him after that? He went back and then it was the First World War, which was still very much on the go.
Shackleton brought all of his men back. He wasn't sufficiently healthy to go to the war. He had a problem with his heart. Which makes his exploits on the ice even more remarkable. Yeah. And he knew that he had something wrong with his heart, and so he never let any doctors examine him because he knew that he wouldn't be passed for a medical. So he went around, he tried to do he had a posting to South America where he was trying to be in charge of propaganda for the Allied war effort. And finally, the war ended, and he was left washed up in the shores of history and with nothing to do. And he was one of those people who just didn't fit in society. He was no good at business. He was no good at politics. People liked him, but it just wasn't his element. And he gathered up another expedition. He still hadn't paid off all of his debts on the Endurance expedition, but he managed to scrounge together the money. Sure. And he sent out word to all of these men who'd been through this terrible experience and said, I'm going back to the South Pole.
How about it?
And Frank Wild, who was in Africa, who was on a farm in Africa, dropped his plow share and went straight back. And they came from all like over
those,
the world.
It's like one of those Greek mythologies.
It is exactly
like right, that. Where Pheidippides runs into the town and rouses the people. And then suddenly all the men who've been farming and being fathers and doing domestic things suddenly pick up their swords and old armor and dust it off.
Exactly.
And off
Agamemnon comes along and says, chaps, we're going to go get Helen back.
Right.
Like, yes.
It's
yes. Because you're our leader. Yeah.
So do you think, by the way, that's a personality thing?
Yes.
Do you think adventurers are a certain kind of personality?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that those personality types are the ones that come out in sometimes antisocial ways when adventure is not available. And so he goes back, he gets this expedition together, and his men come, they rally around him, some of them with toes missing from frostbites. and they go and he sails off, and there's no clear plan of what they're going to do. They're just going to go down to Antarctica and find an adventure. And they go down and they get to South Georgia and they head out. And just before the ship sails off to Antarctica, Shackleton writes in his journal, it's great to be here under the Antarctic skies again. His last line in his journal is, I'd looked out and I saw a a single gem-like star shining and reflecting on the bay. And he goes to bed and has a massive heart attack and dies in his cabin, floating on this bay, just on the eve of his last great adventure. And he's about to be taken back to be buried in England, and his wife sends a message saying, no, that's where he belongs.
Really?
He should stay in the Antarctic. And so the boat turns around and goes back and to South Georgia, and he's buried there on a hillside overlooking the old Whaling Bay.
There are a lot of the guys who were on that endurance expedition who never spoke about it.
Yeah, that's right. In fact,
the second officer had never said a word about it in his life post the expedition, right?
Yeah, that's right.
He must have tried to track down family and try to find out information.
Indeed. And I spoke to the son of one of the members of the expedition. I spoke to him last week, actually, in Cape Town. And I said to him, you know, what was it like? You know, your dad was this great adventurer. He'd been there, you know, unlike my, you know, my dad also told me he'd been away, but you actually had the photographs to prove it.
Yeah.
And he said, well, you know, it's like the rest of that generation, the ones that went to war, the ones that were in prisoner of war camps, the ones that fought in North Africa. He would say, yeah, I was on the boat, and I was with Shackleton, and well, what was it like, Dad? Well, it was quite cold, but then we came home again, and that generation didn't talk about
they didn't talk about their feelings, but they didn't dare boast or be braggadocious. That would have been hopelessly socially inappropriate.
That's
right?
Exactly right.
You would have been shunned.
Yeah. They would all say, well, that guy was heroic. Yeah. I just did my duty. You know, I was just there. I just tried not to let anyone down.
that's
which,
the sort of language.
Which is amazing.
Yeah. Do you think we still have people like that in the world?
I'm sure we do. We just don't hear them on social media. Yeah. So the voices we hear are the people who are braggadocious, the ones who are telling you what they did last night and what they think about this and that. And so I think in that era, humility and sort of quiet duty was expected and respected. But now all we do is we amplify the crasser voices.
And do you have, after doing this work and producing this book, do you have some kind of yearning to do something truly outrageously adventurous yourself, even dangerously adventurous?
You know, I actually don't. I as a young fella, I always thought, you know, I must go out and prove myself, test myself against the world, do something magnificent so that I can boast about it afterwards. But actually, I think I'm finding adventure in other ways that aren't life threatening, but that are kind of
infinite game stuff.
Infinite games, exactly, and moving out of comfort. I find that more exciting, or as exciting and as adventurous as climbing up a mountain.
And when it's very, very cold, like it was last week, do you think of these people often?
I do, and I feel ashamed.
You know, that you're complaining with your
that I'm complaining
or your
with me.
Or...
Frank Wilde said, you know, he after he came back from the ice, he said, you know, I'm never going back to the cold again. And he went to Malawi where he worked. He says sometimes in the 45 degree heat while he was plowing his field, and he'd be tempted to complain about the heat. He'd remember the ice, and would carry on going. And I think, man, those guys, I'm not like them, and I wish I was.
I can't think of a better place to end it. That's beautiful. It's poetic. It's as great as the book. Perhaps not as great as the book, but it's close. So here it is. It's called Finding Endurance, Shackleton, My Father in a World Without End by Daryl Bristow Bovey. Do yourself a favor. Pick this up. You will not stop reading, and you will love every bit of it. Thank you so much.
What a great conversation. Thank you.
Great to see you, my friend. And we'll catch up around your next book in 10 years.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. In the meantime, get that house built in Greece, please. We've got things to do.
I'm boarding the Gareth Cliff Wing.
There we go. I love it. Daryl Bristow Bovey, everybody. CliffCentral.com.